Welcome to History Lost in Time, from one enthusiast to others.
And welcome to episode 13. Here I will talk about another defendant at the Nuremberg War Crimes Tribunal, Wilhelm Keitel, head of the Wehrmacht High Command.
Why this topic today?
This episode is part of a series in which I will discuss every defendant at the Nuremberg War Crimes Tribunal. The sorting is random and has no particular reason behind it, except that I found it useful to group the defendants. After discussing Alfred Jodl, it made sense to discuss the other representative of the army, Wilhelm Keitel. I will do the same with Admirals Raeder and Dönitz, although I am not sure yet whether they will be the next ones. When it comes to Wilhelm Keitel as a person, I probably won't be able to say anything new. There are many documentaries and books that talk very thoroughly about his life. Therefore, I will only briefly discuss his career. The main focus will be on the trial, his opinions, and opinions about him.
Political background and commentary.
No political background. This isn't about glorification of the Nazi regime, nor about the damnation of Germany. I will try to talk in a neutral fashion about Wilhelm Keitel, his opinions, the opinions about him, and the verdict of the tribunal.
The sources.
The career info will come mostly from Wikipedia. It's not controversial anyway. My book sources are the following. Walter Walimont im Hauptquartier der deutschen Wehrmacht 1939-45, translation at the Wehrmacht Headquarters from 1939 to 1945, published by Verlag Weltbild, Augsburg 1990. During the war, Walter Walimont and Wilhelm Keitel closely worked together at the Wehrmacht High Command. Richard Overy, Verhöre, translation interrogations, published by Verlag Propyläen, Ulstein Heine List, München 2002. In this book you can read about the Nuremberg War Crimes Tribunal and individual interrogations. Gustav M. Gilbert, Nürnberger Tagebuch, translation Nuremberg Diary, published by Verlag Fischer, Frankfurt 1962. Gustav Gilbert worked closely with the defendants as a psychologist during the trial in 1945 and 46 and talked to them individually and in groups. Albert Speer, Erinnerungen, translation, Memories, published by Verlag Ulstein, Frankfurt, Berlin, Wien, 1969. Albert Speer was Hitler's favorite architect and minister of armaments and also a defendant at the trial. Heinz Guderian, Erinnerungen eines Soldaten, translation, Memories of a Soldier, published by Motorbuchverlag Stuttgart, 2003. Guderian served as a general of the tank corps during World War II. Josef Goebbels Tagebücher, translation Diaries, published by Ralf Georg Reuth, Verlag Pieper, München, 1992. Josef Goebbels was Minister of Propaganda in the Third Reich and wrote very detailed diaries. Let's start with a brief overview of Keitel's career. He was born in 1882 in southern Lower Saxony. He came from a conservative family. His father was a landowner. And he wanted to follow in his footsteps one day. At age 19, he joined the military and chose the mounted artillery. That was a common step at the time. First a career in the military, later a career as a landowner. Within a year, he made it to the rank of second lieutenant. In 1909, he married Lisa Fontaine, daughter of a manor owner. He had 6 children with her. Keitel's peacetime career was average. In 1910, he was promoted to first lieutenant. Right at the outbreak of World War I in 1914, he was wounded by grenade fragments. He returned as a captain to the front line and commanded an artillery battery. In 1915, he was transferred to the general staff. He mostly served at the Western Front. His time at the Eastern Front was limited. After the war, he remained with the armed forces and served as a teacher for cavalry tactics. In 1923, he was promoted to major, meaning he wasn't promoted for the entirety of the war plus 4 post-war years. In 1925, he was transferred to the troop office. In 1927, he got another command and was put in charge of an artillery regiment. In 1929, he was promoted to lieutenant colonel and transferred back to the Ministry of War. In 1931, he was promoted to full colonel. It took until 1933 before he got another command again. In 1933 he met Hitler for the first time and was very impressed by him and National Socialism. In 1934 he was promoted to Major General. In 1935 he became head of the Wehrmacht office within the Ministry of War. Here he tried to improve coordination between Army, Navy and Luftwaffe, however without much success. However, promotions now arrived quickly. In 1936 he made Lieutenant General, in 1937 he was promoted to General of the Artillery. During the Blomberg-Fritsch crisis at the beginning of 1938, Hitler got rid of the Wehrmacht leadership that didn't support his plans and replaced the men with those that did support him. Among those was Keitel, who was now head of the Wehrmacht High Command and reported directly to Hitler. At this point, it might make sense to stop and explain what Keitel's job actually was. The title head of the Wehrmacht High Command indicates that he was the number one of the German military, like a commander-in-chief. However, that is wrong. Hitler himself was commander-in-chief since 1938. Keitel also was not a deputy or some kind of number two. His job was to deal with administration and communication. The army, the navy and the Luftwaffe organized themselves and managed their operations on their own. And if something operational actually came from the Wehrmacht High Command, it came from Alfred Jodl. Keitel managed the organization of people and material, espionage, prisoners of war, the wounded, administration, communication and coordination. In effect, he acted like a private secretary of Hitler, who transformed spoken orders into written orders and distributed them to the people that needed to get them. During the entire war, he didn't command any troops in the field. Keitel didn't develop any initiatives or strategies. After his promotion to Field Marshal in 1940, following the victory over France, he reduced his role to supporting Hitler. He supported him in his decisions, pressured people that resisted Hitler's decisions, and that's basically it. Keitel embraced his role so much that he was derided as Lackeitel, a mix of the term lackey and his name Keitel. It appeared as if he didn't have an opinion of his own anymore. While this derision did have ironic traits during the successful years of 1939 and 40, after 1941 and especially after Stalingrad, this turned into despise from both the political leaders of Germany as well as from the frontline officers that had to deal with Keitel. Care for some examples? Joseph Goebbels, Minister for Propaganda, was very busy with writing a diary during the war, and he mentioned Keitel several times. From 1937 to 41, his comments were neutral positive. Criticism started in 1942, and by 1943 that criticism was devastating. On March 2, 1943, Goebbels had a longer conversation with Reichsmarschall Göring, and he noted the following on page 1904. Even in Göring's eyes, Keitel is an absolute zero who cannot be taken seriously. Albert Speer mentions a similar opinion from Göring in his memoirs on page 276, also from 1943. According to him, Göring said the following: Bormann and Keitel are actually just secretaries to the Führer. What do they think they are doing? By their own authority, they are nothing. On March 18, 1943, Joseph Goebbels wrote down his own opinion about Keitel on page 1915. Where Keitel is an absolute zero. He is a locomotive without fire, burning up its last steam and then suddenly stopping. On February 29, 1944, page 1998, Goebbels elaborated on that. Keitel is a moron and moreover lacks character and a sense of stance. He lacks character and is a definitive opportunist. One could describe him with the term sentence finisher. He only watches what the Führer says and strives to complete any sentence the Führer has started as soon as he recognizes its tendency. His personnel policy is downright horrific. On March 14, 1944, page 2021, he wrote down what kind of impression Keitel made on others. However, one should be cautious here, as Goebbels had the tendency of transferring his own opinion onto others. Keitel doesn't enjoy a shred of trust or authority in the Wehrmacht, and especially in the army. It would be better if he left sooner rather than later, but the Führer will be reluctant to part with him. However, in the interrogations book, Albert Speer confirms this negative opinion about Keitel. On page 244, the following statement from Speer during an interrogation is quoted. The hatred increasingly focused on Keitel, who was described as a complete failure. Goebbels actually tried to get Hitler to dismiss Keitel. However, his attempts only started in 1944. Even if he had succeeded, it is doubtful that this would have made much of a difference. In any way, Hitler refused. According to him, Keitel really wasn't that good. However, there was nobody that was better. By late March 1945, however, Hitler also talked very negatively about Keitel and Jodl in Goebbels' presence and accused them of being unable to make any decisions, and yet he still kept them. Goebbels wasn't the only one that tried to have Keitel replaced with someone else. General Guderian tried the same. From 1943 to 45, he worked closely with Hitler, first as the Inspector General of the Tank Forces and later as the Army Chief of Staff. In his book, he mentions this on page 274. Of course, Keitel was convenient for Hitler. He tried to read every thought in Hitler's eyes and to carry it out before it was even spoken. Manstein was inconvenient. He had his own views and expressed them. Guderian wasn't as devastating in his opinion about Keitel as Goebbels. However, he also saw a weakness in character and a lack of an opinion. On page 421, he elaborates. Field Marshal Keitel was fundamentally a decent character, striving to fulfill the task assigned to him to the best of his ability. He soon found himself under Hitler's spell, and the longer he remained under it, the less he possessed the strength to break free from this hypnosis. His Lower Saxony loyalty proved its worth until his death. Hitler knew he could rely on this man without reservation, therefore he retained him, even though he was aware of Keitel's strategic qualities. The field marshal had no influence on the course of operations. His responsibilities lay in the area of administration, the mission of the former war ministry. Keitel's misfortune was that he lacked the strength to resist Hitler's orders, which were legally and morally questionable. This was the only explanation for the issue of orders such as the Commissar Order, the decree on the treatment of prisoners of war and inhabitants of enemy territories and others to the troops. Guderian often clashed with Hitler over military matters. Following those clashes, he also had arguments with Keitel, who was opposed to that kind of criticism of Hitler's thoughts, and who gave everyone a dressing down for doing that. Keitel simply didn't accept any other responses than "Yes, mein Führer." According to General Warlimont, Keitel was nothing more than an office manager for Hitler. According to him, Keitel allowed himself to be pushed into this role without resistance. He even managed to convince himself that it was his job to make Hitler's opinions his own and to push for Hitler's decisions in all directions, against everyone and everything. For this and nothing else, he used up all his energy. Appeals by frontline officers to support them against Hitler were pointless with Keitel. In his memoirs, Albert Speer talks about an incident on pages 263-264 that took place during the Stalingrad drama. On one of these days, in the anteroom of the Situation Room, I witnessed Zeitzler pressing Keitel, practically begging him to support him at least today with Hitler, so that the evacuation order for Stalingrad would be given. It was the last chance to avoid a terrible catastrophe. Keitel emphatically agreed with Zeitzler and solemnly promised him the requested assistance. However, when Hitler again emphasized the necessity of holding out in Stalingrad during the briefing, Keitel approached him and pointed to the map, where a small remnant of the city was surrounded by thick red rings. "My Führer, we will hold it." It's no surprise that officers that were betrayed by Keitel in this way started to despise him and lost all respect for him. On pages 257-258, Albert Speer says the following regarding Keitel. Hitler, true to his nature, gladly accepted advice from people who viewed the situation even more optimistically, even more illusorily than he did. This often applied to Keitel. Whenever Hitler made decisions that were accepted by the majority of officers, albeit without consent and rather silently, Keitel was often the one who tried to convincingly reinforce Hitler's position. Constantly in Hitler's immediate vicinity, he had completely succumbed to his influence. From an honorable, solidly civil general, he had developed over the years into a flattering, insincere, instinctless servant. Fundamentally, Keitel suffered from his weakness. The hopelessness of every discussion he initiated with Hitler had finally led him to abandon any independent opinion. Had he resisted and persistently defended his own view, he would only have been replaced by another Keitel. By the end of the war, Keitel's lack of opinion and insistence on repeating propaganda phrases became downright ridiculous. On page 357, Albert Speer talks about the critical situation that developed after the Allies started bombing fuel production factories. Starting in spring 1944, the situation was that less fuel was produced than was required for military operations. While Speer and other specialists tried to explain the severity of the situation, Keitel responded with using hollow phrases. Quote, Keitel, on the other hand, always trying to please Hitler, said in a downplaying manner that he could overcome the difficulties with his reserves, before concluding with Hitler's standard argument. How many difficult situations have we overcome already? And then turning to Hitler, we will overcome this one too, my Führer. Rarely is the opinion about a person as clear as in the case of Wilhelm Keitel. Whether you asked conservative military members like Generals Warlimont or Guderian, opportunistic economy leaders like Albert Speer, or radical Nazis like Joseph Goebbels and Hermann Göring, all shared a negative opinion of Keitel. The only difference is that a few had some level of compassion. That's it. Keitel shared a similar fate to Alfred Jodl because he put his signature under a lot of criminal orders that Hitler had given verbally. By that, he made these orders his own. Additionally, he defended and pushed for Hitler's decisions aggressively against everyone and everything. From the beginning, Keitel was involved in planning and executing wars of aggression, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. Another set of examples, Keitel was involved in the following criminal actions with his own orders. The extermination of the Polish elite, an action that cost the lives of thousands of Poles. The actions of the Einsatzkommandos behind the front lines during the campaign against the Soviet Union. Keitel's orders made this possible. Several retaliatory orders given by Keitel that targeted Yugoslavia and resulted in the murder of countless civilians. And that's just a small sample. You can find Keitel's signatures under many criminal orders. Let's talk about how Keitel experienced the end of the war. He was present when Hitler was the target of an assassination attempt in July 1944, and he remained unharmed. When he saw that Hitler had survived, he cried and even hugged him, which was totally against the way people treated Hitler normally. After that, Keitel took an active role in hunting down and punishing the assassins. In April 1945, he and the remains of the Wehrmacht High Command left Berlin and joined Admiral Dönitz in the north of Germany. There he experienced the end of the war. While Alfred Jodl signed the surrender in the West on May 7, 1945, Keitel signed the surrender in Berlin on May 9, 1945, because the Soviet Union insisted on a repeat of the procedure. Following that, Keitel was allowed to return to the Wehrmacht High Command. He was arrested on May 13, 10 days before the rest of the remaining German government was arrested. While in prison, he wrote his memoirs, which unfortunately are not available to me at this time. Should that change, I might use them one day for another episode. Keitel didn't do well in prison. According to Albert Speer, he looked very run down. His mental state was even worse. The fact that he was treated like a common criminal shattered his feeling of self-worth and destroyed his self-respect. He started developing sort of an opinion on some things again, since Hitler was no longer influencing him. However, Hermann Göring tried to replace Hitler in that way now. At the Nuremberg War Crimes Tribunal, Generals Keitel and Jodl and Admirals Raeder and Dönitz were the representatives of the military. The cornerstones of Keitel's defense were: I was only following orders, I was only Hitler's office manager, and I didn't even have a command. With that, he ultimately failed. All four indictments, planning and executing wars of aggression, conspiracy against peace, war crimes, and crimes against humanity, could be easily proven by the many, many criminal orders that Keitel had signed. The tribunal considered participation as important as incitement, so the fact that Hitler ordered things and Keitel only executed them made no difference. This left Keitel a very bitter man. Tribunal psychologist Gilbert quotes him on pages 316 and 317 with the words, "As I already told Jodl, if Hitler wanted to be supreme commander, he should have had to remain so until the bitter end. He gave us the orders. He said, I take responsibility. And now, when the time has come to truly assume responsibility, we have to answer for ourselves alone. That's not fair. He should have borne the responsibility like a soldier until the bitter end." Albert Speer reported that when he was visiting the front lines, he often heard that visits by Keitel and Jodl would be very much appreciated as well. At the front line, soldiers had the impression that headquarters had no idea how the situation truly was. According to Speer, headquarters actually didn't understand how hard the Russian winter really was, or how much soldiers in the West suffered because of the total air supremacy of the Allies. Just to mention two examples here. While in prison, Keitel started to realize this. Following a day where the campaign against Poland and the occupation of Poland were discussed, Keitel said the following, which you can find in Gilbert's book on pages 80 and 81. "I'm dying of shame. It's shameful, horrible. I had at least expected the Wehrmacht to behave honorably, but now the Wehrmacht too is covered in shame. They had too many connections with party organizations, like that horrific incident with the Warsaw Ghetto. I wish I had spent more time in the field. I spent too much time at Hitler's headquarters, and when I went to the front, I asked the generals. I should have seen what was really going on in the lower ranks. But what's the point? Now it's too late." Gilbert then asked him if Keitel thought whether Hitler had given the orders for these atrocities or whether he had known about them. Keitel replied very energetically, "He must have done it. There's no doubt about it. Now I understand why he always ordered me to stay away from police matters. Whenever something was going on, he'd say, 'It's none of your business, you're a soldier.' No, he spoke three completely different languages. One for the Wehrmacht, one for the party leaders with whom he discussed his true plans, and one for the Reichstag, which he used to address the public." When the concentration camp movie was shown, Keitel was shocked and just hung his head. In the conversation with Gilbert following that, he said, quote on page 54, "It's terrible. When I see such things, I'm ashamed to be German. Those filthy SS pigs did it. If I had known, I would have said to my son, I'd rather shoot you than let you join the SS. But I didn't know. I'll never be able to look anyone in the face again." On pages 30 and 31, Gilbert gives his own evaluation of Keitel. Despite Keitel's upbringing in the spirit of Prussian officer tradition, his behavior during interrogations in his cell was almost servile. The chief of the high command of the German Wehrmacht kowtowed and bowed before every lieutenant who came to him, protesting what an insignificant little man he truly was. Without his rank and power, he possessed as much backbone as a jellyfish. The idea that a field marshal could be held legally responsible for orders given or carried out evidently never seemed to have dawned on him. Whenever he was now confronted with his own orders and actions, he asked, "What should I have done?" Keitel insisted that he had to follow orders, no matter what. Content of the orders, irrelevant. Criminal orders, irrelevant. Keitel insisted that he had no command of his own, that he had no deep knowledge of Hitler's plans, and that he had no options. In his opinion, refusing an order would have resulted in the death penalty. Stepping down from his position would have been like desertion, so again death penalty, and that he wasn't ready to commit suicide. According to his own statement, he was against the persecution of the Jews, but he claimed to have been powerless regarding that. During the trial, Keitel was confronted with the plans to attack Germany's victims in the war, the criminal orders he had given, and the, in some cases, catastrophic conditions within prisoner of war camps. He was unable to mount a convincing defense against that. While most of his co-defendants were quite content with his actions at the trial, their opinions about his personality remained negative. Admiral Dönitz hid behind the phrase that Keitel was an honorable man. Vice Chancellor von Papen called him an honorable man without intellect. Chief of the Reichsbank Schacht continued to call him a lackey and later said this to Gilbert, page 233. It sounds very righteous, but that doesn't change his guilt one bit. So what if he just followed Hitler's orders and did nothing else? There's no law in the world that obliges me to commit murder. A document that Admiral Rader wrote while he was imprisoned by the Soviets and that was used at the tribunal created quite the uproar. In this document, Rader said the following about Keitel. See page 332. Field Marshal Keitel, a man of almost unimaginable weakness, who owed it solely to this quality that he was able to remain in this position for so long. The Führer could treat him as badly as he wanted. He put up with it. However, when it came to Hitler's rise to power, Keitel saw some responsibility at the Western Allies. On page 96, Gilbert quotes him saying the following. But I must tell you one thing, Professor. An American simply cannot understand our desperate situation after the Treaty of Versailles. Just think. Unemployment, national disgrace. Let me say frankly, the Treaty of Versailles was a complete mess, and that's how every decent German must have felt. Just imagine ripping out Prussia's heart and giving Poland a corridor to the sea. No wonder it was easy to convince people that Poland was just stubborn and selfish when it denied us Danzig. Every decent German must have said, down with the Treaty of Versailles, by all means, right or wrong. He also criticized that Hitler was allowed everything, whether it was remilitarizing the Rhineland or annexing Austria. In the end, Keitel made quite a pathetic impression on Gilbert. On page 112, Gilbert quotes the Field Marshal saying this. I hardly talk to the others. Believe me, the last few years have been hell for me. And now, when I'm fighting my despair alone in the cell, it's even harder. The only one who understands me at all is Jodl. But you are the only one I can tell what's on my mind, because you are above it all or not involved in it. And I can tell you, I suffer greater pangs of conscience and remorse in this cell than anyone will ever experience. I believed in him so blindly. In the end, Keitel was found guilty on all charges and sentenced to death by hanging. On page 417, Gilbert describes his conversation with Keitel following that sentence. Keitel was already in his cell with his back to the door when I entered. Abruptly, he turned around and saluted at the other end of the cell with clenched fists and stiff arms. There was naked horror in his eyes. Death by hanging, he announced, his voice hoarse with deep shame. That I thought at least I would be spared. I don't blame you for staying at a certain distance from a man condemned to death by hanging. I understand that completely. But I'm still the same person I was before. If only you would come to see me sometimes during these last days.
Finishing words.
Let's finish this episode with the same questions that I used at the end of the Jodl episode. Question: was Keitel a Nazi? Clear: no. His upbringing and his career were those of a conservative. Military career, landowner. You can't get much more conservative than that in Germany at that time. However, he was definitely a Nazi sympathizer. After meeting Hitler for the first time in 1933, he was under his spell, and that led to his accelerated career under the Nazis. Question: was Keitel a helper of the Nazis? Clear yes. He did everything, really everything, that Hitler wanted him to. He used all his skills and all his energy for Hitler and his goals, never questioning them. You can't be more of a helper than that. Question: how did Keitel act towards Hitler? Subservient. All other defendants had some sort of independence and their own opinion. However, Keitel lost himself in Hitler's will and sacrificed his entire personality. Even old political comrades of Hitler weren't this subservient. Question: did Keitel do the things that he was accused of? Clear yes. Keitel's actions and his signatures under criminal orders made it easy for the prosecution to make their case against him. The fact that he only gave these orders and didn't execute them himself made no difference. Question: is the death penalty justified? Well, there we reach the controversial point. I'm having issues with that, just like in the case of Alfred Jodl. Would it have been okay to sentence Keitel to life imprisonment? I think so. Compared to some frontline commanders who ordered, supervised, and executed atrocities on their own, Keitel really didn't do anything on his own. That doesn't make his orders any less inhumane, though. And I have to agree with head of the Reichsbank Schacht here, who basically said that just following Hitler's orders doesn't reduce Keitel's level of guilt. My main problem is the imbalance of the verdict. Hard against Keitel and Jodl, but incomprehensibly lenient against other officers. I would prefer uniformity in harshness or mildness. However, everyone has to decide that for themselves.
Thank you for your interest.